to learn our history. When do we want it?
Now!
What do we want?
To learn our history.
When do we want it?
Now!
For the second year, communities nationwide are defending their freedom to learn in a National Day of Action on May 3rd. Activations will happen across the country that day to protest the censorship of stories and ideas from our education system. Every Thursday leading up to the May 3rd National Day of Action, the Freedom to Learn Network will host a digital homeroom where activists, artists, scholars, students, parents, and educators can discuss what's at stake and begin mobilizing for the Day of Action and for Freedom Summer 2024. As the war on woke undermines the majority's desire for a multiracial democracy, it's time to build our own infrastructure to defend our schools and workplaces. Join the Freedom to Learn homeroom every Thursday this month to see how you can get involved. Register for free using the Freedom to Learn Network's link tree, or follow the host of this show, Dr. Kimberly Crenshaw, on Instagram and Twitter for more information on how you can get involved.
I'm Kimberly Crenshaw, and this is Intersectionality Matters, the podcast that brings intersectionality to life by exploring the hidden dimensions of today's most pressing issues, from Say Her Name to the war on woke, DEI and CRT, and the global rise of fascism. This idea travelogue lifts up the work of leading activists, artists, and scholars, and helps listeners understand politics, the law, social movements, and even their own lives in deeper, more nuanced ways. Every generation, a small number of artists come along who have undeniable staying power. And in these rare cases, you just know that you're going to be listening to this artist for the rest of your life. For me and for countless others, Luther Vandross is one of those artists.
We have with us today, who do we have? We have...
Luther Vandross!
Mr. Luther Vandross.
If you ask me what my favorite Luther songs are, I might say, A House Is Not a Home. Any Love.
Everyone needs a lot, no doubt. Any love. Any love.
There's Nothing Better Than Love.
I wanna be loved. There's nothing better than love.
Superstar, a remake of a Carpenter's hit.
Don't you remember you told me you love me, baby?
They're just too many to have one favorite. Every time I hear one of those songs, I get transported back to the era when Luther and his golden voice first broke into the mainstream.
And a house is not a home when the two of us, we are far apart.
That's why this year at Sundance Film Festival, the new documentary, Luther, Never Too Much, was at the top of my list of things to see. The film explores Luther's rise to fame, as well as his struggle behind the scenes with racism, his body image, food addiction, and sexuality. It's the brainchild of esteemed director Don Porter, who I'm thrilled to welcome to the podcast today. Don and I will talk about Luther, of course, but I also want to pick her brain about why she covers the types of stories she's known for. Much of Don's work tells the story of American life from the perspective of characters who are normally relegated to the margins. Luther Vandross is one prime example. Racism, colorism, and fatphobia follow Luther throughout his career, thwarting his chances of receiving all of the awards he rightly deserved. Don skillfully explores the nuances of this intersection in her film. And she's done the same thing with other stories that require an intersectional lens for the full tale to be told. In 2022, for example, Don executive produced a docuseries called 37 Words. It chronicles the impact of the passing of Title IX. Title IX, of course, is the federal civil rights law prohibiting sex-based discrimination at educational institutions. In the series, Don explores how Title IX changed the world of athletics for women. It forced educational institutions to extend women the same chances to play sports that men receive. And in her 2016 documentary, Trapped, Dawn explores the laws regulating abortion clinics in the South and their devastating impact on Black women, low-income women, and those who count themselves as both. She also directed a television series called Deadlocked, How America Shaped the Supreme Court. It's a primer on how the Supreme Court has been wielded as a tool of the far right, giving context to how a decision like the reversal of Roe versus Wade came to be possible. Intersectional analysis is at the heart of Dawn's work on these issues, and it gives her work unprecedented nuance. That's why Dawn has received accolade upon accolade, including Critics' Choice Documentary Awards, several Gracie Awards, an Emmy, and a Peabody, just to name a few. She's hailed as a changemaker and a mainstay in the film industry. And in an era where Black stories and ideas are being censored by anti-woke legislation, it's never been more essential for Black women to take storytelling about this country into our own hands. We'll also get into Dawn's experience as a Black woman in film and whether the ban on Black stories has affected what she makes and how she makes it. So let's dive in. Dawn, welcome to Intersectionality Matters.
Thank you so much. It's such an honor to be here in conversation with you.
And the pleasure is completely and totally mine. I am so excited about this conversation, first of all, because we do have common interests. I love documentary. I love storytelling. I love the stories that you've told. They completely overlap with so many of my interests. And to find out that you also were trained as a lawyer was doubly interesting. So I'm just so curious, both as I plot my second career, but also as I reflect back on your trajectory, how did you go from working in law to working in film?
I was working as a litigator. I'd gone to Georgetown Law School, and I was working in Washington, D.C. And I would say I was not an unhappy lawyer. I just love the process of thinking and of working through puzzles, which when the law is at its best in some ways, that's part of what we do. But I would say that even though I was basically happy, I didn't feel complete. I felt like there were parts of my brain, of my interests that I wasn't quite getting at work. And because I guess I'm a millennial and we think we should get all the things in our jobs. But really what happened is I had worked for a person who did some First Amendment work. And when he left and went to ABC Television in New York City, he wanted to know if I would go with him in-house. And at that time, I was brand new married, you know, looking around. The life of a law firm partner did not seem to me to be conducive with the kind of parent I wanted to be, the kind of relationship I wanted to have. And then, you know, on an even more personal level, my best friend at the law firm had died. And she was in her 30s, and she died of ovarian cancer. And it was such a wake-up call. I didn't know anyone my age. She was a little bit older than I was, but not that much, who had died. And it was, you know, you get this like bolt of lightning thinking, wait a minute, is this all there is? Is this what I'm going to do for the next, you know, 40 years? I think I want to do some other kinds of things. I think I should be challenging myself more. I should be doing things that are a little bit scary. And so for all those reasons, we picked up and moved to New York, even though we were quite settled. My family lives in Washington, D.C. Everything seemed like it was lining up. And I was like, you know, maybe it shouldn't seem like it's lining up when I'm 30, you know, maybe I should be taking some more chances. So I went to work there. It ended up being very good training, you know, the capability to read things and kind of suss out whether we were fairly reporting something. And then I went to A&E Television, and working at ABC News, I was like, oh, that's how they do this. It's not rocket science. I could do this. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, if you haven't been to film school, if you haven't had an internship, which, you know, is so often, these are not things that are accessible to mm-hmm. people who look like us. And right. so seeing what was actually involved, what documentary is very similar to what we as lawyers do. It's taking something complicated and telling a story that makes it accessible to an audience. And that's what you do to a judge or a jury or an arbitrator. So the skill sets were very similar. And then my father was a photographer, so I always had this interest in visual medium. So all those things together, but really it was this feeling that maybe I could do this. And why not try and figure that out? Why not make that the puzzle that I was interested in solving?
That is so exciting and eye-opening. You're absolutely right that one of the skills that we have to hone as lawyers is telling an accessible story about complicated phenomena. That's much of what we do in AAPF. It's what I do with intersectionality. But I never thought that that might be a stepping stone to being a documentary filmmaker. So if I wind up there, I'll have to thank you for opening up the door. We first thought about the possibility of having this conversation in January when we were both at the Sundance Film Festival. We were there to host a conversation about the war on Black storytelling. Why artists need to be aware of it, how it is that the brilliance that our storytellers have long been able to bring to the table is under threat now. So that was the work part of what we were doing. But then the fun part was getting to see the documentaries that we were looking forward to. So I made a beeline for Luther. I just was so looking forward to it. And Luther, Never Too Much, the title of your documentary about Luther Vandross, just hit every note that any Luther fan could have possibly hoped for. It was just amazing. So first of all, congratulations for that achievement. It's a beautiful, beautiful film. I was struck by so many things about it. The first thing is how you framed it as a story about joy. I wanted you to say more about that. And then I want to tell you some complicated things I felt sitting there listening to this person who brought joy to so many people. But yeah, let's start with the theme.
I literally had like a physical tingly reaction hearing you ask the question that way. I just can't even tell you how deeply I appreciate this conversation. I'm like almost teary because Luther, so often the stories about Black people are they grew up poor, the music saved them, they had to escape, et cetera, et cetera. That is a common story. That is a story for many people. That is not his story. Luther is born to two loving parents who loved him and his siblings and instilled in him a sense of pride and accomplishment and purpose. And so that is why we literally start the film with little Black children in Harlem. I wanted to set the scene. And so they're jumping rope. There's, you know, I live in Harlem now. My mother, both my parents grew up in Harlem. I haven't always lived here. I am so in need of Harlem right now. And when I walk down the street, I am able to see faces. I do not see a blur of humanity. I'm able to see community. I see color. I see a cadence of a neighborhood. My neighborhood is actually pretty quiet. There's always like some knuckleheads in the city who are, you know, acting up or whatever, but it's really a family, quiet neighborhood that has its own kind of cadence. And what I try and do in films, particularly in films that are historical, is think about what would he have seen? What would be surrounding him? What would be inspiring him? And I thought, well, he would have seen these people on the streets. He would have heard the skipping rope. He would have heard the music on 125th Street. And so that's what we put in to start. And then just in case anybody missed it, I had Joan Rivers asking him the question, were you very poor as a child?
No, and I'm so glad you did that.
And he says, poor, rich. We had toys at Christmas. We had love. Like, my childhood was great. And it was so important to me, because this is the truth about his story, to center it that way, that this is a person who believed in himself. He didn't have to find his belief. He believed in himself. He then passed that on to other people. But so your framing of that question, these are the conversations like you saw in the film. That is what we do as filmmakers. That was intentional, that it was framed that way. So you are centered in excitement and joy and gasping in delight.
Sheer delight. And realizing that he was the voice that was the soundtrack for our lives before we knew it was him.
Well, that was the other delightful surprise for me, because growing up, you know, Let It Be Low and Brow, like we used to listen to the radio all the time, right? And you hear all these commercials, all these jingles. I didn't know those were Luther. I didn't know that he sang on all of Nile Rodgers, all of Chic, that he's on every album. I'm like, what? How could this be?
Luther was everywhere. He was everywhere.
Luther was everywhere. And so I felt like it was really important to set that table, because then when you think about how difficult it was for him to reach the top of the pop charts, you feel that even more, because you're like, this is literally ridiculous.
Because he did it. He clearly had any formula that was necessary. People were paying him to put his music and his voice on things they wanted to sell, not just to Black folks, you know, but to everyone. So if he was already able to market his voice to market things, then what is it telling us that it was such a challenge to get him played in all of the stations, to get him in the pop charts, to get him the recognition he deserved?
I am so completely appropriating that framework. He was used as a sales tool to America. He was the number one backup singer for all of the most popular products, as long as you weren't seeing his face.
And then you add to that, then he becomes the backup singer for the biggest acts of the era, Bette Midler.
We left out half of them. Carly Simon, you know, Barbara Streisand.
Just everyone.
Everyone wanted that voice.
One of the things that you did that I loved, so I'll out myself as a failed musician because my parents were musicians. I won't even say failed because they didn't even want me to try, because I was just not good at it. But what was so amazing also is that you showed his artistry, not just in vocalizing himself, but the way he arranged music.
Professor, you're getting an A on film theory here. And that too was intentional, because whether or not we recognize it, Black people's talents are always described as natural.
Natural. That's right.
They didn't work for it. They just happened to be a diva.
Mm-hmm.
He worked for this. Of course, he had some God-given talent, but then he worked at it. He worked at songwriting. He was always arranging. He was always writing. He was always collaborating. He was always honing his craft in an intellectual as well as a physical way. When we do not acknowledge work, we do not give credit to talent. That is a way of undermining and taking away the power that should be his. And so one of the things that was very important to me and was more accessible to me because we were working with Sony is we had those rehearsal recordings. So you could see him leading his singers. You know, when Lisa Fisher says he's like a director for the music, he's casting voices because he knows how they will sound in harmony. So it was important to give him that intellectual props as well.
To be
And it allows you to understand what it is you are enjoying, what your expectations are when you come to listen to Luther's music, how he created that expectation in you by the exercise of his hard work, his skill, his attention to detail, his ability to hear how it's all going to sound when it's together, which gives you the experience of joy.
And that is the thing, is when you see somebody who has worked so hard and you understand what goes into the creation of this joyful noise, then it's so satisfying when it emerges.
Yes.
Because you are going along with him. You know, that's why we put Never Too Much at about 30 minutes into the movie.
Yeah. And we're ready for it.
Never too much, never too much, never too much, never too much.
You're ready for it here. Like by the time the audience gets to that point, everybody's ready for that release of that song that they all know. They're ready for it. And then you can take some of the harder things that are about to come. You're with him.
Yes.
You understood the journey to get, like, Never Too Much didn't just pop out of nowhere.
Exactly. And you're so right that one of the most frustrating things about documentaries about artists, particularly singers, is you don't really get to sing along. You don't get to hear the song. You get a couple of bars and you're just kind of frustrated. Here, especially when it was clear that you were going to be able to lean into it a little bit more when Never Too Much came, it was just anticipation, because the next thing that comes on, we're going to get a chance to sing a little bit of that too. It was kind of like a concert slash documentary. So we could sing along and then we could see what was behind the scenes. And then we could sing along and we could see what happens next. And we could sing along and hope he gets the Grammy for the song that we were all listening to, and be sitting there kind of pissed off when he does it, right? And finally excited when he finally does. I mean, we were with him through the whole thing. And that's the artistry and the hard work that you brought to it. I said that I had some complicated feelings. And so I was weeping by the time it was over. I mean, like real tears. I can still feel it, of both the gratitude to him because he is the soundtrack of so much of our lives, especially our love lives. You know, when I think back to the times I was listening to Luther, I think about who I was with and what we were feeling, and his ability to capture that moment. I mean, I'm sure there are hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people who are walking this earth whose lives were made possible because of the way Luther's music made people feel. And at the same time, he answered the question, which song was most
any love. Yeah.
Any love. And immediately those lyrics, you know, came to me. And it just, it kind of broke my heart right there.
And I say, oh my, in a lot of ways, you're a lucky guy. And oh, now all you need is a chance to try any love. Crying and let me out. Are all those feelings that I want to touch anymore?
Because this man made love possible for so many people, and yet it escaped him.
And, you know, one of the things that was so interesting, and we're quite indebted actually to Oprah Winfrey's show, because she usually doesn't allow you to use that much footage. There's usually a limit on how much footage, which I understand. And for this, she let us use, because they really had a relationship. I think he was on her show 14 times. And that's because over time, they were experiencing this similar struggle with weight loss in public.
Very much.
And so they really bonded over that. And then of course she was there, you know, so, but when he answers that any love, and I love that song so much. And when he says that's the only really biographical song, and then Marcus Miller says, you want to know Luther? Listen to Any Love. And what always gets me is when Oprah asks him about the song, he can reel off those lyrics right away. For an audience to understand how much of himself is actually in that song. You know, when we have a connection with an artist, when I grew up, we used to read the liners on the record albums. Like I would sit with my girlfriends in middle school and we would read every single thing on the back. When you have digital music, you don't have that experience. And there's a layer missing of your connection to what the artist is trying to tell you. The other thing is, we used to listen to an album the way that it was sequentially organized.
Yes.
Yeah. An artist is telling you something with the organization of maybe you're supposed to have a breath here. Mm-hmm. Maybe mm-hmm. you're supposed to have an instrumental moment, you know?
Yes.
And I really appreciated that in making this film. And so I also listened to whole albums in the way that he organized them because I started really appreciating what he was giving to us.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Like nothing with Luther is accidental. Everything was very well thought out.
That is such, that would be the tagline for the documentary, right? Nothing with Luther was accidental, down to the costumes.
Those are the actual costumes. We went to the storage facility and filmed those costumes. The estate has them in deep storage. And then we had those drawings that he made, those sketches.
He actually sketched the costumes.
He actually sketched those, yeah.
Was there anything that Luther could not do when it came to
I don't think so.
Artistry and performance? I mean, he was such the total package, and yet such a struggle to cross over, such a struggle to get the desserts that should have been his for a variety of reasons. And you were sensitive in touching on some of them. So when we saw him first as a teenager on Sesame Street, and it's like, obviously he's the most talented person there. And just as obviously, they're going to have him in the back, you mm-hmm. know, both because of his weight, his skin tone, all of these things make him not immediately the guy that you think is going to be the superstar. So you've got that already in the mix. You've got his voice and his talent. And you also have the questions that were consistently being raised. I was really struck by the constant questions about his sexuality and how you allowed a range of people to speak to it. People speaking to whether it should be spoken to or not, whether fidelity to his wishes and the way he dealt with those questions would be honored or not by speaking to it. And then someone else who did choose to speak to it. How did you go about navigating that? Because that was a very complicated,
yeah.
you know, line for you to draw.
One thing that's particularly difficult when you have a person who's passed on is they don't have the chance to speak for themselves. And so thematically, it was important to me as much as possible to let him answer questions the way that he would want to, not the way I would answer.
Right, right.
He gets to decide how he wants to live his life.
I loved when you allowed us to see him say, I am not here to talk about that.
It was very complicated. Personally, I feel like I'm such a strong advocate for all people to live their lives free of discrimination and hatred. And I had a long conversation with a gay couple. And how do you navigate if somebody doesn't want to be identified? I don't want to be seen as homophobic. I want to make sure that everyone is celebrated and welcomed. And yet I also have a fidelity to the wishes of your subject. It's the hardest thing. It's like being a parent in some ways. You're like, it's not my place to mm-hmm. speak for him here. And so we worked on that quite a bit. And it was the thing that I was the most nervous about. And so at the screening, when he says, I don't owe you answers mm-hmm. to those questions. What I owe you is my talent and doing my best. And when people clapped for that, that was a big moment for me. Is it going to be satisfying to somebody who is gay and wishes that he had made some different choices about what to share? Mm-hmm. No. But I think that there is, if we really do believe in self-determination, he was so clear about conversations about his private life and about mm-hmm. not wanting to share that publicly mm-hmm. that I felt like on balance, that was the honor that needed to be respected.
Yeah. It was a balance that was struck. And I think for those who have a strong sense of the temporal dimensions of what it was like in the 80s, I think for many people, it will speak to that. It's not as though the issue wasn't raised at all
yeah.
and there was no attention given to it at all, but the attention was an effort to balance what he felt comfortable with and what helps explain part of his story as well. The other thing that I was struck by, you know, there are three people that I was listening to on rotation and all three of them are you know, gone. Well, actually four when you count Prince. I really was thinking a lot about the terms that get imposed on our artists, what kind of life they have to lead, what kind of love they need to perform. And when it comes to Luther and to Whitney, the pressure to fit within a box, both in terms of, you know, sort of shrinking their voice and shrinking who they were and who they wanted to love in order to reach that brass ring. That was sort of an undercurrent that you can't not think about, really, if you've looked at Whitney through this lens and then him. And it's just sad and also somewhat ironic that the people who are behind the scenes have more freedom to express who they are than the actual artists themselves.
When people think it's just about the talent is the price of entry. It's all the rest of it that comes, how you can navigate that pressure cooker. And for Whitney being so extraordinarily beautiful with that voice, people wanted her to be the Barbie package, you know? And if you dangle, you are acceptable, Whitney, with your straight nose and your high cheekbones to white people. Mm-hmm. And so she's trying to deal with all of that and be who she is. You know, I think you understand that. And so for Luther, he was going to be authentically himself, but just refused to believe that people would not appreciate his talent if given the opportunity to hear it. Mm-hmm. And that's also a delicate conversation. And his conversation with Arsenio says, why are you portrayed as a Black artist? Because, of course, none of us want to imply that there's something wrong or lesser than, but his thing was, let people hear me and decide if they like it. He loved his Black audience. He was just blackety black, 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 dark chocolate. Like, one thing that I really got from Luther in terms of his music and performance and his confidence, he was completely at home authentically himself. He knew exactly what he wanted to be and what he wanted to do. On the personal side, there were struggles. Musically, I've never seen somebody as comfortable in his own skin. He knew exactly who he wanted to be musically.
Yeah. And I think that, you know, a lot of people may not be fully aware of how segregated music, I'll provisionally use past tense, aware at the same time that we just came from the Grammys. And, you know, Jay-Z made the point that the person who won the most Grammys of all time has never won Album of the Year. So there's still these dimensions going on about where your art is thought to appropriately live.
I don't want to embarrass this young lady, but she has more Grammys than everyone and never won Album of the Year. So even by your own metrics, that doesn't work.
I mean, Beyonce's two country songs turn the world inside out.
On its head. On its head. You know? And for some people, playing Luther on the standard radio format seemed to them like he should be over here, over in R&B, not here, which is one of the things that contributed to how long it took for him to get the audience and the recognition that he deserved. So there's so much in the documentary that makes you think about what are the continuing dimensions of this? Where can we find the fingerprints of what he was calling out and experiencing directly? So I know people are going to get a lot out of it. When and where will people be able to see this amazing documentary?
Well, the film is not yet sold, and so we're searching for a home.
Well, help people understand exactly what you just said. The film is not yet sold.
That film was privately financed with Sony Music Publishing and Sony Finance, but I had creative control. So they provided the financing, but what they did is they opened up the vault, essentially. They provided the music, any pictures they had, those recordings. And then as a filmmaker, I was allowed to craft the story. I will tell you, this is the most well-reviewed film I've ever made. I've made more than 12 films and multiple series. I think that I accomplished every single thing I wanted to with this movie. I cannot wait to share it with audiences. I'm a little surprised that we haven't yet found a home.
Just, this is my little editorial. One of the things that happens at Sundance Film Festival is that films are premiered and buyers buy films so that they can be distributed and you listeners can have access to them. Films that are extraordinarily well-reviewed like Never Too Much was?
It's on the best of list, like for all of them, for Hollywood Reporter, IndieWire, Esquire, People.
Everyone loved this film. So usually that means that the filmmakers leave with a deal. If not immediately, it's because there's a bidding war or other details that have to be worked out. So this is a great film. Everyone thinks so. And we're still waiting for it to be sold. So keep waiting for it, folks.
I'm going to have to get Black Twitter involved. I'm like, there's nothing else to do.
We're going to have to do something about this because, you know, this is joy that we are being denied. Anyone who grew up listening to Luther, anyone who has parents who used to play Luther or grandparents who used to play Luther will want to see this film. I mean, the audience is there.
This is my third Sundance film. And for this film, the programmers put it in the largest theater, a theater of 1,200 seats. It was completely sold out.
And no one wanted to go.
And no one wanted to leave. And what was also so joyful about that is Sundance is not a Black event.
That's
and
right.
So people trust the programmers. You know, there were certainly some fans in the audience, but there were probably many more people who were coming to him without a lot of knowledge. And so for it to get that reaction from an audience that is not an audience of super fans, that was very gratifying to me. And that's what I think is possible. So to me, we have the perfect storm. We have a hardcore fan base who will come out with word of mouth, and then a whole new audience who, one of the many, many things that this film has brought to my life is he had such a respect and admiration for Black female artists. And he spoke about them constantly, about Dion and Aretha. And so part of this is also my tribute to them is that look what they gave to this child. They gave him this creative vision that he then so beautifully executed.
Oh, the scene that he's singing, House Is Not a Home to Dion.
She's crying.
Laid me out. Just laid me out.
And when I interviewed her, which was also, you know, this is my job now to interview Ms. Warwick. And she knew that when Luther was a young man, he used to pretend that he was related to her. And when he eventually became friends with her, he was like, I used to tell people I was your cousin, you know. Like, and she, but what a circle to, you know, come from being a kid listening on the radio and on Ed Sullivan to then not only becoming friends, but writing for your idol.
Ugh.
And then singing her songs for her with his own arrangement. The idea also that he sang The Carpenters.
Every song he took, he made better.
Yes.
It was just incredible. You gave us so much to celebrate again. You gave Luther back to us. And it's my hope that Luther will be given back to a broader audience. We need to do anything possible to make sure that it's known that this is a diamond, and it's not a diamond in the rough. It's a polished diamond. It's ready to be seen. I wonder if we could just in the last few minutes, we could step back and just share a little bit about your career overall, Dawn, and especially as a Black woman creative in this industry. Lately, there's been more talk about some of the conditions and the challenges than there has been in a long time with Taraji's conversation about just how hard it is for her to reach parity with other people, white actors who are not as accomplished as she is. And then a chorus of people coming out saying she's speaking the truth here.
And I heard on the street, Taraji, you had the audacity to say you're thinking about stopping acting. Are you thinking about it?
I'm just tired of working so hard, being gracious at what I do, getting paid a fraction of the cost. Mm-hmm. I'm tired of hearing my sisters say the same thing over and over. You get tired. I hear people go, you work a lot. Yeah. Well, have to. The math ain't mathing.
You know, you might see fabulousness and glory, but behind the scenes, there's a huge disparity. And everybody knows it. Right. I'm wondering, as an actual filmmaker, are there aspects of this that you see?
Yeah. You know, I think if you're a Black creative, there is this constant balance. You do need to be vigilant about your credit without bragging. You do want to publicize what you're doing without complaining too much, but there's complaining to be done. And so I admire her being honest about her struggles. We need to be more honest about these things if we are to address them. How would we address them if we don't know that they're happening?
Right.
You know, it's very easy for us to be pigeonholed. As much as I live and breathe civil rights stories, I made the film about John Lewis, you know, but I try and choose projects that show breadth and show the scope of my curiosity. But then there's always a piece of me and what I'm looking for. And yes, I'm looking for the Black in the stories, and it's always there. You know, I made a 4-part series about Bobby Kennedy called Bobby Kennedy for President. And I literally said to Netflix, this is going to be the Blackest Bobby Kennedy you've ever seen, because he was influenced by so many Black people. He did not just become a civil rights advocate. He started out as a McCarthy lawyer, as a really rough and tumble kind of guy. It wasn't that he was any more racist than the average white person. It's just that that wasn't his primary focus. He became sensitized to civil rights activity through the work of Marion Wright, who then marries his aide, Peter Edelman. She becomes Marion Wright Edelman, through John Lewis. John Lewis was in his 20s and had volunteered for Bobby Kennedy's campaign. And on the day that he organized the rally in Indianapolis for the Black audience, Dr. King is killed. And a very young John Lewis says to Bobby Kennedy, you must address them. Bobby Kennedy's white aide said it's too dangerous. And RFK listens to 20-something-year-old John Lewis. And he addresses the Black audience that day. He tells them that King has died. And it's the only time that he ever mentions his brother's murder in a public address that way. The only time. And that is one of the cities that did not burn that night. When you understand that you have these seminal interactions, you know, Harry Belafonte organizes a group of Black activists to come to RFK's apartment, and they tell him, they give him what for? They tell him they are not grateful for the crumbs that he has given. And he's angry. But instead of demonizing them, he digs in and he starts to educate himself. Yes. These things do not just happen. They're made. And they are often made in collaboration with some people who are not always highlighted.
I also want to mention Deadlocked, that explores how the Supreme Court has shaped America. And I wonder, as we ponder the stories that you're just telling, so much of the story of us, the signature event that I've been doing at Sundance, the full story of us is yet to be told. So I'm wondering, as you see the censoring that's happening, so many books are being censored, the source material for so many films that actually capture elements of our existence that have fallen by the wayside, the Hate U Give, Just Mercy, The Color Purple, all of these books are being censored. I'm wondering how you connect the dots between what's happening at the Supreme Court level, pushing back against racial justice, what's traditionally happened in Hollywood to suppress some of the storytelling that allows us to see more clearly why democracy is so important to defend. How are you sitting with this moment? What are you connecting to help you navigate?
This is something John Lewis literally said to me. He said, when we are at our most attacked, that means we are becoming the most successful. Mm-hmm. And there's a fear that we are too powerful. And so it is even more important that we continue to truth tell and to figure out ways to get the truth out. So the Supreme Court series, I didn't go into it thinking this is going to be a series about how race has influenced the court. And yet that is so the story that emerges, because that's the story that's there. And so when you look at the abortion conversation, when you look at why the evangelicals decided to merge with Catholics, that is so that they could preserve their racially segregated schools' tax exemptions.
That's right.
That's what that's about. Evangelicals weren't anti-choice. And we forget the origin story. And so if you accept at face value the fictions that are perpetrated, you will not understand the forces that are working around you. So I feel like that's my job. And the reason I work in archival so much is if I just tell you that, it's not as powerful as if you see Mitch McConnell, which we have in Deadlock, saying, you can put up any nominee you want, we will shoot them down. And that's exactly what he does when Merrick Garland comes to play. That was not an accident. That man has the longest grudge memory ever, because it was it was 2 decades later that he refuses to give Merrick Garland a hearing with almost a year left in Barack Obama's presidency. And yet when Amy Coney Barrett comes up, which I think was 28 days, where we were already voting, he pushes through her nomination. And that even further cements the court in the far right extremist version of itself, which it is. So if we don't know that this was generations in the making, then people are under the mistaken impression that if they don't vote for Trump, that we'll be fine. And that is not the case.
That is so, so important. One of the points of departure for a course I teach called Race Representation in the Law is that more people get their information about how our government works, about what their rights are, about what is discrimination, about what they have a right to expect from what they see in film, than what they read or what they hear. If that is the case, then it behooves us to be able to use this medium to communicate those stories, to tell what the intersections of racial justice and gender justice actually are. How is it that the losses in one area become losses in another, how they're all tied together? If we don't tell those stories, people won't know them. And that's the best condition of possibility for the other side to drive this project over the edge, which is currently what we're looking at if we don't step in to try to save our democracy.
What happens when there are not enough creators of color who are inserting their voices? I'm under no illusion that my opinion or, you know, vision or creative approach should ever be the only. It is meant to be part of the chorus so that people have a number of different perspectives to evaluate, see what resonates with you, kick the tires on my work, kick the tires on everything that you read, hear, and see. But if you don't have somebody saying, did you think about it this way, then you know, you allow the loudest voices to dominate.
The heckler's veto.
The heckler's veto.
So what I take away from this is, first of all, the inherent possibility of being able to tell the stories that have not yet been told in ways that help people see things that they've never seen before. So the possibility is endless. Our challenge is dealing with gatekeeping.
Which is why, and it's something that's extremely important to me, if I can get a project greenlit to bring in as many other creators. So, you know, I'm the executive producer of Eyes on the Prize, which you so graciously interviewed with us for, but we had 6 different directors there. Mm-hmm. We had 6 different teams. And that was intentional because it was like, how many folks can I employ on this very well-funded project that's going to have a high profile? So if we're not working, we don't get the experience to be excellent. That's part of the job too, is, you know, blocking and tackling where possible.
We have benefited so much from your presence, from your vision, your creativity, and frankly, your courage to take up these stories and to put everything that you put in them, knowing that they need to be told. So now the ball's in our court to make sure that we find these stories, we support these stories, and wherever we can, open up the gate so that the stories can land where they need to land. So Don, thank you so much for dropping by Intersectionality Matters. I was so looking forward to this conversation.
More joy has been received on this end. So I appreciate you and all of the ways that you contribute to preserving and teaching and communicating our history, our American history, our Black history. I just am so admiring of all that you have contributed and really very grateful for everything that you do.
Thanks, Don.
Thank you.
This episode of Intersectionality Matters was produced by senior producer Nicole Edwards, with support from Jocelyn Walker, Sanaa Hashmi,
and the team at the African American Policy Forum. Mixing by Sean Dunham. To support our show, subscribe, leave a review, and follow us on social media. I'm your host, Kimberly Crenshaw, and we'll be back soon.
Louis Scarcella was the greatest homicide detective of his generation.
I am the protector of these people. I am the guardian that they need.
Derek Hamilton was the best jailhouse lawyer of his.
And the law was my girlfriend. It was all I had.
What happens when a group of convicted felons take on the cop who put them away?
We gotta attack Scarcella.
Come and get me.
Listen to new episodes of The Burden on the iHeartRadio app or wherever you get your podcasts.